who declares that the pharaoh Necho of the 26th dynasty commissioned some Phoenicians to attempt the circumnavigation of Africa, and that starting from the Gulf of Suez southward, they did finally come back through the Mediterranean to the Nile Delta. They took nearly 3 years to complete their voyage. Each year they landed and sowed and harvested a crop of wheat before going on. Fourth, the great trading cities of the Phoenicians are the most striking of the early manifestations of the peculiar and characteristic gift of the Semitic peoples to mankind, trade and exchange. While the Semitic Phoenician peoples were spreading themselves upon the seas, another kindred Semitic people, the Aramaeans, whose occupation of Damascus we've already noted, were developing the caravan routes of the Arabian and Persian deserts and becoming the chief trading people of Western Asia. The Semitic peoples, earlier civilized than the Aryan, have always shown, and still show today, a far greater sense of quality and quantity in marketable goods than the latter. It's to their need of account-keeping that the development of alphabetical writing is to be ascribed, and it's to them that the most of the great advances in computation are due. Our modern numerals are Arabic, our arithmetic and algebra are essentially Semitic sciences. The Semitic peoples, we may point out here, are to this day counting peoples, strong in their sense of equivalence and reparation. The moral teaching of the Hebrews was saturated by such ideas. With what measure ye mete, the same shall be meted unto you. Other races and peoples have imagined diverse and fitful and marvellous gods, but it was the trading Semites who first began to think of God as a righteous dealer, whose promises were kept, who failed not the humblest creditor, and called to account every spurious act. The trade that was going on in the ancient world before the 6th or 7th century BC was almost entirely a barter trade. There was little or no credit or coined money. The ordinary standard of value with the early Aryans was cattle, as it still is with the Zulus and Kaffirs today. In the Iliad, the respective values of two shields are stated in head of cattle, and the Roman word for money, pecunia, is derived from pecus, cattle. Cattle, as money, had this advantage. It didn't need to be carried from one owner to another, and if it needed attention and food, at any rate it bred, but it was inconvenient for ship or caravan transit. Many other substances have at various times been found convenient as a standard. Tobacco was once legal tender in the colonial days in North America, and in West Africa fines are paid and bargains made in bottles of trade gin. The early Asiatic trade included metals, and weighed lumps of metal, since they were in general demand and were convenient for hoarding and storage, costing nothing for fodder and needing small house room, soon asserted their superiority over cattle and sheep. Iron, which seems to have been first reduced from its ores by the Hittites, was to begin with a rare and much desired substance. It's stated by Aristotle to have supplied the first currency. In the collection of letters found at Tel El Amarna, addressed to and from Amenophis III, already mentioned, and his successor, Amenophis IV, one from a Hittite king promises iron as an extremely valuable gift. Gold, then, as now, was the most precious and therefore most portable security. In early Egypt, silver was almost as rare as gold until after the 18th dynasty. Later, the general standard of value in the Eastern world became silver, measured by weight. To begin with, metals were handed about in ingots and weighed at each transaction. Then they were stamped to indicate their fineness and guarantee their purity. The first recorded coins were minted about 600 BC in Lydia, a gold-producing country in the west of Asia Minor. The first known gold coins were minted in Lydia by Croesus, whose name has become a proverb for wealth. He was conquered, as we shall tell later, by that same Cyrus the Persian, who took Babylon in 539 BC, but very probably coined money had been used in Babylonia before that time. The sealed shekel, a stamped piece of silver, came very near to being a coin. The promise to pay so much silver or gold on leather, that's to say parchment, with the seal of some established firm, is probably as old or older than coinage. The Carthaginians used such leather money. We know very little of the way in which small traffic was conducted. Common people, who in those ancient times were in dependent positions, seem to have had no money at all. They did their business by barter. Early Egyptian paintings show this going on. Fifth, when one realizes the absence of small money or of any conveniently portable means of exchange in the pre-Alexandrian world, one perceives how impossible was private travel in those days. The first inns, no doubt a sort of caravansary, are commonly said to have come into existence in Lydia in the 3rd or 4th century B.C., That, however, is too late a date. They're certainly older than that. There's good evidence of them at least as early as the 6th century. Aeschylus twice mentions inns. His word is all-receiver or all-receiving house. Private travellers must have been fairly common in the Greek world, including its colonies, by this time. But such private travel was a comparatively new thing then. The early historians, Hecateus and Herodotus, travelled widely. I suspect, says Professor Gilbert Murray, that this sort of travel for history or for discovery was rather a Greek invention. Solon is supposed to have practiced it, and even Lycurgus. The earlier travellers were traders travelling in a caravan or in a shipload, and carrying their goods and their miners and shekels of metal or gems or bales of fine stuff with them, or government officials travelling with letters of introduction and a proper retinue. Possibly there were a few mendicants and, in some restricted regions, religious pilgrims. That earlier world, before 600 BC, was one in which a lonely stranger was a rare and suspected and endangered being. He might suffer horrible cruelties, for there was little law to protect such as he. Few individuals strayed, therefore. One lived and died attached and tied to some patriarchal tribe, if one was a nomad, or to some great household, if one was civilized, or to one of the big temple establishments, which we will presently discuss. Or one was a herded slave. One knew nothing, except for a few monstrous legends of the rest of the world in which one lived. We know more today, indeed, of the world of 600 BC than any single living being knew at that time. We map it out, see it as a whole in relation to past and future. We begin to learn precisely what was going on at the same time in Egypt and Spain and Media and India and China. We can share in imagination not only the wonder of Hanno's sailors, but of the men who lit the warning beacons on the shore. We know that those mountains flaming to the sky were only the customary burning of the dry grass at that season of the year. Year by year, more and more rapidly, our common knowledge increases. In the years to come, men will understand still more of those lives in the past, until perhaps they will understand them altogether.